Hello, Lehigh Valley.
My name is John Andre, and I'll be your host for this half of today's broadcast, presented to you by Professor Benjamin Cohen and his class, 10 Ways to Know Nature. For the past 2 months, my classmates and I have been studying what it means to know nature. Although we all believed that we knew nature before starting class, we've come to discover new subtleties about nature we completely missed before. From artwork and galleries, to ancient religious scriptures, to even the things we buy and eat, we've learned things that we believe are worth sharing to all of you listening today. Seeing as it is the holiday season, and many people are out this time of year shopping for their loved ones, it seems fitting to begin this broadcast with knowing nature through consumerism. I'm here with Alex and Emily, who went out and did research on how consumerism affects how people treat and come to know nature. Can you give those who are listening today a brief summary of what your research was, or even what your main goal or theme was of your segment?
To start, we really wanted to get a feel for how Lafayette students view consumerism and how they think it's affecting nature.
And since it is the holiday season, we really wanted to tie in and how consumerism is affected throughout this time of year.
Well, with that in mind, we'll begin your segment of this broadcast.
Hey, Macklemore, Ward, can we go thrift shopping?
I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a come up. This is being awesome.
Nah. Hi, I'm Alex Eglow.
And I'm Emily Lindahl.
To gain more insight on the topic, we interviewed three Lafayette students around campus. Here are the thoughts of Jason Chevelle, Andrew Sager, and Jillian Hall. What do you think of when you think of nature?
I think nature is the innate state of environment before anything tampers with it. You know, that like the surroundings, the foliage, the trees and everything before anything tampers with it, touches it, before it's ever polluted. It is the perfect state of everything, exactly how it was.
I think of a forest, trees, animals, and a complete ecosystem.
What do you think consumerism is?
Consumerism is the encouragement of purchasing goods and benefiting the economy.
I think of consumerism, I think of this derogatory word that's put out there to define people who like nice things and like to buy them. It's like it's always paired with materialism, those people who, you know, they have to have stuff and they have to buy stuff. But it's really not such a bad thing. It kind of seems to be the point of human interaction for us to go out there and continue to make things and continue to better ourselves, and then for somebody to pay us to continue to do it.
And how do you think that consumerism and nature relate?
I think consumerism in many instances utilizes the elements of nature for man-made purposes. This could be good for humans, but bad for the environment.
I think we destroy nature to make more for ourselves in terms of products.
During both the interviews, I found it really interesting how both Andrew and Jason thought that nature had to be pristine and untouched by man.
Yeah, I completely agree.
They really did, and that belief reminded me of the preservationist Wallace Stegner. You know, Stegner believed the same thing, that nature was pristine, and that if humans interacted with the land, they were destroying it, no matter what the interaction was. But I would more side with conservationist William Cronin and his beliefs that, you know, we need to acknowledge that we're humans are a part of nature, because otherwise we will completely disregard nature and just take advantage of it and destroy it.
Yeah, I really know what you mean, because when I heard Jill's point of view that she thought consumerism was kind of an economic principle kind of thing, I didn't really see it that way. When I first heard of consumerism, I kind of saw it more as how Jason saw it, where he put us into it and tries to explain that we've always been a part of it. Like, this is how our society has been run for so many years.
Yeah, definitely. I never realized before that maybe consumerism is just part of human nature.
Yeah, and you know what was also interesting was how both Jill and Andrew recognized that the environment is being so hurt from all this consumerism, which like really brought me back to Manning's point of view, that of nature as wealth, and how now when people see nature, they see it more for their monetary value instead of the beauty that it was seen for before. And now it's just, what can we do with this new product or something, rather than, wow, we should respect this kind of nature. It's like been around for so long.
Yeah, definitely. I think our interactions with consumerism have definitely shifted. I think that we need to acknowledge the fact that consumerism is harming nature. But I bet when people go out to the grocery store or to the mall and they're picking out something to buy, they aren't thinking about the environmental impacts that purchase could have.
Have a holly jolly Christmas. It's the best time of the year. Now I don't know if there'll be snow, but have a cup of cheer. Have a holly jolly Christmas. And when you walk down.
Well, it's that time of year again. Holiday season. Crazed parents, stressed mall employees, and hopeful kids waiting for that perfect gift to arrive. I know that it's my favorite time of year because I love the experiences and thrills of trying to find the perfect gifts for my loved ones.
I know, I feel the same way, Emily. I love all the beautiful lights and decorations and getting to see all my family when we celebrate together.
Yeah, but as much as we love the holidays, it seems to me like each year the Christmas season gets longer and longer as advertisers start pushing the holidays earlier each year. With a longer season, we're bound to consume more. More ads means more gifts every kid wants, and with more gifts comes more production and waste. I feel like the holidays are becoming more of a consumer frenzy than a religious time. As Horsley put it, the traditional and current celebration of Christmas in America has little to do with the birth of Christ.
Yeah, and even Hanukkah, which is considered to be a minor holiday in the Jewish religion, has now turned into a huge ordeal. I remember in Sunday school, my teachers would always remind us that the holiday isn't even in the Torah, yet it always seemed to be everyone's favorite. Consumerism has turned this once small celebration of the Maccabees' battle with the Syrians and the miracle of the oil burning for 8 days straight into the holiday for big business and gifts galore. This entire time of year has become the mecca for industry, with stores profits at their heights and shopping malls turning into the new focal point for the holidays.
Wow, it's really fascinating how consumerism can transform an entire society and two religions. I know that when Jason said that consumerism is a part of human nature, I don't think we ever intended consumerism to make such drastic changes as it has. I mean, think about it. With not only Christmas becoming a consumer holiday, Hanukkah is now too. That's a whole 8 more days of presents and waste.
Yeah, and the environmental impact for these holidays is quite amazing. Just think about the amount of Christmas lights that are put up, whether it's in the malls or your favorite neighbor's house that's always decked out to the max. The amount of electricity being used is unprecedented. Plus, all the beautiful Christmas trees, as beautiful as they are, they have to come from somewhere, and cutting down all of these trees can't be helping our carbon dioxide issue.
Yeah, Alex, and the issue extends even farther than that. All of those gas emissions coming out of cars travel to and from malls and to various toy stores, and all those trucks that ship out the products around the U.S. and beyond. I can't help but wonder whether we actually need all of this stuff. I know when you're 5 years old, not getting that new bike seems like the end of the world, but I think that that's just a concept that consumerism has created. Will there ever be a time when Hanukkah and Christmas return to their religious roots?
Yeah, Emily, I don't know. It seems to me that our consumerism has grown to the point where it's completely out of proportion, and our society depends on its excessive consumerism in order to function. Rather than nature being the basis of our global community like it used to be, consumerism seems to have become the new thing that connects us. Overall, I think it's safe to say that this absence of nature and abuse of it is getting out of hand, and people should start being more aware of what they were consuming.
Well, I hope we inspired you to view consumerism and nature in a different light and enjoying tuning in. Have a happy holiday season, and while you're running around trying to find those perfect gifts, remember to be a conscious consumer.
And coming up next is Luis and Julia talking about another way that we consume nature, through food.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since
we're going to help the next person, please.
Can you get the burger, please?
Burger.
The
next person, please.
Hi, I'm Luis Gomez.
And I'm Julia Shank. Welcome to our podcast. We're broadcasting live from Lower Farragut at Lafayette College.
Today we're exploring consuming nature through the food provided and served at Lower Farragut.
We will begin by conducting interviews of Lafayette students who regularly eat here.
Excuse me, can I ask you a question really quickly?
Yeah.
What is your favorite thing to eat at Lower Farragut?
I quite like the chicken Caesar salad.
Okay, what about you?
Well, I usually eat, you said Lower Farragut?
Lower Farragut.
I usually get a grilled cheese and french fries.
Okay.
And my fourth item.
Okay, do you know where it comes from or where it was produced?
No, I think the catering staff tried to source locally, but I really don't know.
Okay, what do you think?
I'd like to think that it comes from some sort of farm, as advertised, but it tastes good to me, so I'm going to keep eating it.
All right, thank you.
Most students don't think about where their food comes from or how far it travels to end up on their plate, just like the chicken Caesar salad or their burger with fries.
If you picked up any of these products at Lower Farrenon, such as this Back to Nature brand of mac and cheese, for example, would you know how it got here all the way from Fresno, California?
According to World Watch, American food travels an average of 1,500 to 2,500 miles from farm to table.
What? That's crazy.
Yeah. That's why local farms have a better impact on our consumption, since we know where the food is grown or raised, and we can go directly to the source if we have any concerns regarding the process.
So we should grow our own crops? Can we do that here in Easton?
As a matter of fact, we've already started doing just that with La Farm, which is the student-run farm at Metzger Field, where students learn about sustainable agriculture, as well as provide a small portion of food that we eat in our dining halls through Bon Appetit services.
Oh yeah, I think I read something about Bon Appetit sustainability by issue and sustainability by product policies. I read that local farming supports the local economy, farms contribute more in taxes than they require in services, whereas suburban development costs more than it generates in taxes, according to several studies.
That's right. Also, local farming is more nutritious. Did you know that fresh produce is highest in nutrients just after harvest? Foods that are just harvested and then frozen and canned are more nutritious than some fresh produce that has been on the truck or supermarket shelf for a week. As a matter of fact, I had a conversation with Sarah Edmonds, who is the Metzger Environmental Projects Coordinator and La Farm Community Garden Working Farm Manager.
And how much food is given back to the dining hall?
Everything that we harvest, we sell to the dining hall at this point. So this year it was just about a ton of food, a little bit over a ton of food, so 2,200 pounds that we harvested over 23 harvests. And some of those harvests in the height of the summer were twice a week. And we harvested the vegetables, put them in boxes and carts, weighed them at the farm, and then drove them here to deliver to Farrenon at the beginning of the summer, and then Marquis, and Marquis has been sharing with Gilbert.
Not only is vegetation benefited through local farming, but animals are also treated better. Through the Bon Appetit services at Lafayette, all the ground beef supplied is humanely raised. Also, they use no foie gras or crate-raised veal, and eggs are certified cage-free. Turkeys and chickens are raised without routine antibiotics, in water or feed. And milk and yogurt come from cows not treated with RBGH.
Wow, I didn't know that our dining services made the extra effort to provide us with healthier food products. This just solidifies my claim that local farming is much better than industrial farming. Based on an episode of This American Life I saw, the way industrial pigs are treated with no room to move in a pen is inhumane. They never get to see the outdoors until they get slaughtered. The longest walk they will ever take is down the aisle of the building to the vehicle that takes them to the slaughterhouse.
I'm definitely going to be thinking more consciously about what I'm eating. I hope others will follow my footsteps. Speaking of conscious eating, let's ask some students if they consciously think about what they're eating here at Lower Farrenon.
Do you know who Wendell Berry is?
No.
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 What do you think it means to be a conscious eater?
A conscious eater would probably just be a person that is mindful of the effects that food has on their body, and they eat accordingly to how they want their bodies to be.
Do you think consciously in terms of how much food you consume or what food content you eat?
It kind of depends on where I'm at in my life. Like, a lot of times when I'm busy, I just kind of grab like what I can. It's kind of quick. And if I'm usually not as busy, or if I go to the gym, I usually try to eat more consciously because I kind of get in that mindset where like I want to be like in a more healthy frame. So it kind of goes to like phases. As the holidays come usually, I'm not as much of a conscientious eater. But then like after the holidays, I just feel awful and I kind of really buckle down and I become a lot more conscientious.
Although most students knew what it means to be a conscious eater, many admitted that they don't really think about what they're consuming or where it came from.
In the words of Wendell Berry, eating is an agricultural act. This means that eating is a part of the food cycle, which begins with planting and birth. The process of farm to fork and knowing where the food comes from is the foundation of conscious eating. People should be aware of where the food comes from, how it is grown or raised, and how it ends up at the supermarket or diner where they buy and eat it.
However, many don't realize that they are also a part of this process. They see themselves as the consumers who purchase the packaged goods without questioning the quality of what they're about to put into their bodies. Wendell Berry points out in his article, The Pleasures of Eating, that for most consumers, food is an abstract idea, something they do not know or imagine until it appears on the grocery shelf or on the table. Most people just go along with what's on the labels of the packages, accepting them to be good things without actually knowing what they mean.
Yeah, like the USDA labels. People think that since a product has a USDA label on it, it means that it's better for them or healthier. According to Livestrong.com, the USDA label is very strict, with permission to use certain pesticides, but those chemicals are not listed in the labels. Also, the lack of preservatives to elongate shelf life makes more produce go bad faster than products with preservatives.
According to Brittany Shute from Religion Dispatches magazine, genetically modified foods are not required to be labeled in the U.S., so it's hard to determine whether or not the produce is genetically modified.
A genetically modified organism is an organism whose genetic material has been altered using genetic engineering techniques. Some of the benefits of genetically modified foods are resistance to diseases, drought and cold tolerance, as well as tolerance against herbicides and pests, and nutrition. Plant biologists are working to create plants with genetically engineered resistance to diseases from fungi, viruses, and bacteria. Developing tolerance to weather, insects, and weed killers can make farming more efficient and create more food for consumers. According to ProQuest, crop plants genetically engineered to be resistant to one very powerful herbicide could help prevent environmental damage by reducing the amount of herbicides needed. Another good thing about genetically modified foods is that researchers are trying to find ways to enhance the nutritious value of crops so people have a more healthful diet from eating crops such as rice, especially in impoverished countries.
Whoa, hold up. Yeah, those all sound like good reasons to grow genetically modified foods, but you're not mentioning any of the bad things about them.
Oh yeah, like what?
There are some unintended causes related to genetically modified foods, like harming other organisms. And crops genetically engineered for herbicide tolerance may crossbreed with weeds, which would result in those weeds being herbicide resistant. Also, there may be a higher resistance of insects to the pesticides produced by the plants themselves. If you want to know some of the adverse human health risks, there is a growing concern that introducing foreign genes into food plants may have an unexpected and negative impact on human health. Introducing foreign genes into crops may have a negative consequence in the digestive tract. An economic perspective on this issue is that the more advanced and genetically modified foods get, the more it costs to buy the seeds, and it will be too expensive for small farmers or third world countries, which will increase the gap between the wealthy and the poor.
Okay, I'll admit you had a few good points, but I still think genetically modified foods are more helpful than harmful. Anyway, all this talk about food is making me hungry. I think I'm going to grab some food from Lower.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. I'm Luis. Thanks for listening.
That was Julia and Luis with food. They mentioned in their segment GMFs, which are genetically modified foods, one form of technology. I'm here with Campbell and Eric to discuss another form of technology. What exactly are we talking about, guys?
Hi, today we are going to be discussing how we have come to know nature better through the use of solar panels.
Our aim today was to show our listeners how humans have affected our Earth through different forms of technology. As you will hear more in our segment, it has indeed taken a great toll on our natural world today.
Once again, this is the Eric Joseph. We have a fantastic variety of interesting information coming your way on solar energy. We're bringing in the best of the best in their respective fields of energy, and we're going to hear from some of our listeners on their opinions about solar energy. I'm also joined by my colleague, Campbell Lewis Wayland.
Top of the morning to you. More importantly to the discussion about solar power, we're going to analyze the effect that solar panels have on the way we view nature. Solar panels enable us to think about the way that we currently live in nature and how we want to leave Earth for its future generations. But first, let's hear some background information on how solar energy actually works.
Thanks, Campbell. Solar energy is power from the sun, which is a vast and inexhaustible resource. To answer the question of how solar panels actually work, it's really a simple concept. The photons from the sun penetrate the cells within the solar panel, which then activate electrons, knocking them loose within the silicon layers. Electrons in the bottom layer of the silicon then shoot to the top of the cell and flow into metal contacts as electricity.
That doesn't sound like much of a simple concept to me there, Eric. But hey, if it's helping the environment, then I'm all for it. It seems that the more technology we invent in the modern world, the more pollutants we put into nature. But it seems that solar panels may be the answer to smarter energy. From my research, there are no known global warming emissions associated with generating electricity from solar panels. Although, there is actually a hazardous waste connected with solar panels, but this is not an issue if manufacturers follow U.S. laws to handle these chemicals safely and dispose of them properly.
You know what that means. It's time for our daily email. Today's email is from Betty Michelson. The email reads,
"Hi Eric and Campbell. I'm listening to the show right now, and the discussion about solar panels is very interesting to me, considering I have installed solar panels on my roof this past summer. I am super pleased with my decision to invest in solar panels because I've cut my electric bill by nearly 75%, and I am doing my part in the fight against global warming. The only negatives, I would say, are the aesthetics of the solar panels. It is a very different look, and I can see how some people wouldn't want to install them. In my case, I felt that the money we save on our monthly bills outweighed the aesthetics, so I couldn't be happier with our solar panels."
These points mentioned by Betty seem absolutely true. I can see the reason why a lot of Americans wouldn't get solar panels, because it doesn't look too pleasant on their homes. Maybe if there was a way to integrate the solar panels into the different types of roofing without noticing them, then solar panels would be a much more appealing option. I know that right here in Easton, Pennsylvania, people are taking steps toward alternative types of energy. Just a couple miles away at Metzger Field, there's a turbine that uses the energy conducted from the wind to generate electricity. Just a few miles away from that, there's a giant solar panel farm that generates electricity for the surrounding towns. Next on the show, a man who is very credible in the solar panel industry, Mr. Russ Eulinger.
Hello, Mr. Russ Eulinger. We are calling to hear some of your thoughts on the future of solar panels in the United States.
I think the next 5 to 10 years in the solar industry, with nuclear not as attractive and some of the base industries like coal and natural gas, solar is going to be growing more and more, especially since the cost is going down. As time goes on, it gets more and more efficient, and eventually it'll be able to compete with some of the traditional base.
Thank you, Mr. Eulinger. It seems like solar panels have come a long way in the energy industry and have a bright future ahead of them. Looking at these solar panels, it has enabled me, and I'm sure some of our listeners, to think about how we impact nature today. From the analysis of how we impact nature today, we can then generate the discussion of how human beings want to leave Earth for future generations.
We're here at the Martin Creek Power Plant, located in Martin Creek, Pennsylvania. Today, our primary way to attain energy is through the burning of fossil fuels such as coal and oil. In today's modern world, we use fossil fuels for power plants, vehicle engines, coal power plants, and oil for heating. ScientificAmerica.com reported that natural gas and oil accounted for 87% of the world's primary energy consumption last year. And CBSNews.com recently reported that carbon dioxide emissions have risen to 2.4 million pounds per second. As human beings, we consciously make the decision to continue to burn fossil fuels for energy. I'm now going to hand the mic over to my co-host, Campbell, to tell you the impact these choices are having on our nature.
The more we use fossil fuels, the more our environment suffers. It is amazing that we continue to use fossil fuels while we have solar energy at our disposal. Ice caps are melting, animals are dying, temperatures are rising, and sea levels are rapidly increasing. Whether or not you choose to accept it, it is up to you as a listener, but it seems quite apparent to me that the effects of using fossil fuels is causing global warming and other natural disasters. Next on the show, we're going to have our team of reporters share the information they have gathered on how human beings are affecting nature through their use of fossil fuels.
Our report is on the BP oil spill and horrific effect this has had on the surrounding nature.
Between our marshes, the flower gardens to the west, and the Florida Keys, this oil spill could possibly absolutely destroy three of the most important ecosystems in the whole United States.
It is disappointing and shocking to hear the negative impact that human beings are having on nature. The discussion of solar panels allows ourselves to reflect upon our effect on nature, but also lets us decide how we want to leave Earth for future generations. Over the past 5 minutes, we have uncovered so many problems with fossil fuels that it seems imperative that we use solar panels. We need to change the energy field so future generations can live in the same fantastic environment that we live in today. Solar panels can satisfy our energy needs while reducing our environmental impact on Earth. Solar panels have so much upside that it's hard to argue against them. Similar to our discussion with Mr. Russ Eulinger and so many of our other listeners, the benefits of solar panels are endless.
I would agree with you, Eric, that solar panels are our answer to reduce our environmental footprint. I'm now going to discuss three main benefits that I think make solar panels the best energy source. Number one, a typical solar panel produces around 200 watts of power. To put this into perspective, one basic old-fashioned light bulb uses 60 watts of electricity. Laptops often use around 45 watts, and desktops can run between 150 to 300 watts. Window air conditioning can range between 500 to 1500 watts, and central air conditioning can use 3500 watts. From these statistics, solar panels can be very efficient in an effective way of generating electricity for household items. Number two, solar panels provide energy reliability and independence. Everyone knows that the sun is going to rise and set every day, at least we hope so. With the exception of clouds, which may be a bit less predictable, solar panels produce a steady generation of electricity. Also, once you have installed your solar panels, you have an essentially independent source of electricity that is at your disposal whenever you need it. Number three, unlike any other type of energy, solar energy can save you money. The average 20-year savings for Americans who went solar in 2011 were projected to be a little over $20,000. In populous states like New York, California, and Florida, the projected savings were over $30,000. Wow, that's crazy, Eric.
If you are not convinced by now that solar energy is the best energy for the future, then you will never be convinced. In this podcast, solar panels have allowed us to reflect upon how we as human beings are abusing nature, and has also allowed us to see the necessary changes we need to make in order to preserve our environment. The simple answer to help preserve the Earth for future generations is solar panels. Solar panels helps to reduce the need to burn fossil fuels, and the adoption of solar energy means a correlating drop in air pollution and greenhouse gases. So the next time you are going to make an investment, think about getting solar panels. Not only will you be saving yourself money, but also doing your part in preserving nature for many more years to come.
That was Eric and Campbell talking about solar power and other forms of renewable resources using technology. Not too dissimilar to technology, Carolina and Jen discuss how films influence people to know nature.
Welcome to our podcast,
Nature and Film,
with Jen
and Carolina. In our class, 10 Ways to Know Nature, we discuss how people understand nature through various methods.
Learning about nature through film can be very informative, but also very manipulative.
The cameramen, editors, and directors can pick and choose what to show their audience.
Despite this fact, films are very popular, as people enjoy being taken away from reality and transported to the movie's world.
All films portray nature with their own bias. They show their audience how to view nature in a specific manner. For example, WALL-E and Avatar showed a potential devastation of viewing nature as artifact.
Planet Earth presents the idea of living in harmony with the sublimity of nature. Disney tends to show nature as proof of their own ideal American family. And Studio Ghibli shows the destruction of nature as inherently evil.
In Meinig's 10 versions of the same scene, he covers 10 different ways of understanding the same landscape, such as artifact, habitat, or ideology.
Landscape as artifact is an egotistical way to view nature, saying that nature is made as a tool for humans.
Habitat is one which sees the environment and man as equals, and that man should be able to take and give back to nature in harmonious coexistence.
Ideology is when humans view nature as representative of an idea, or giving nature an abstract meaning.
Avatar is essentially a film concerning itself with environmental advocacy, and their main point is that nature will always win. In the film, the virgin rainforests of Pandora are threatened by wanton exploitation by evil corporate interests that are trying to destroy it. This is parallel to what is happening now in the Amazon rainforest. The indigenous peoples, who have much to teach the developed world, have a planet with functions as a collective, interconnected, Gaiaistic organism. Their way of viewing nature is one that sees it as habitat. A character dies for the sole reason that destroying the rainforest for profit is morally and spiritually wrong. This shows us that nature can have an innate value to it, apart from its service to man.
WALL-E is a movie about humans' disrespect for nature and their preoccupation with technology. The people of Earth have to desert the planet because natural life has been choked out by pollution. The humans live on a spaceship and they lose touch with their own humanity as time goes by. The people become obese and complacent. By destroying the planet, they not only killed every living organism, they destroyed what meant to be human. WALL-E shows how this attitude of landscape as artifact is harmful to both our planet and ourselves. Planet Earth is a nature documentary that shows the physical landscape of our planet from all the four corners and the animals that live on it. Planet Earth was the winner of the Science and Natural History Award, as it was known for its accuracy in its depiction and its low levels of interference. The movie shows landscape as nature as well as habitat. People are never shown, which makes the audience feel that nature is sublime, and it shows that nature and wildlife are beautiful and amazing. However, the narration encourages people to question how they affect what they've been shown.
Disney introduced most of America to nature through film starting in the 1930s. They are famous for anthropomorphizing its animal characters in order to make them more relatable to the viewer. This is also done through the incorporation of the traditional 1950s family unit in many Disney films. In its nature films, Disney is known to alter the environment and its inhabitants, or edit out scenes that don't fit their intended image.
Studio Ghibli began producing movies after the shock of World War II. They portray the abuse of technology as destructive and evil, whereas nature is good and right. Many movies deal with the pollution of Earth as the cause of death and destruction, and only reverence for nature can bring any sort of solution. The animation of the background is far more detailed than that of the actual characters. This allows the immersion of the audience so they can connect with the character's environment and ongoings.
Both Disney and Studio Ghibli focus on creating an ideal, and both were influenced by the horrors of World War II. However, while Disney tries to ignore the more ugly truths of the world, Studio Ghibli calls attention to what can happen if humankind isn't responsible with the environment. Disney inherently portrays nature more as artifact, whereas Studio Ghibli shows nature as habitat.
WALL-E shows us what could happen if humans aren't careful in dealing with the planet.
Planet Earth shows us the beauty of our planet and encourages us to search for solutions.
Avatar shows us that even with our incredible technological advances, humans aren't a permanent fixture, and the planet will continue with or without us.
Disney allows us to relate to nature on a personal level, and even teaches us lessons through nature. When I think of nature in film, I think of The Lion King. The way it humanizes the animal characters has always captured my attention greatly whenever I watched it as a kid, and even now. It in a way allowed me to see wildlife as relatable to my own experiences and what was familiar to me. I remember seeing it as a class in the second grade and being fascinated that an animated movie with no humans shown could make me choke up and laugh out loud. Before this class, I hadn't really put much thought into how my view of nature was influenced by the movies I had seen. But now I realize that films, because they are so popular, can have a hand in shaping my perspective on how I understand and interact with nature.
When I think of nature in film, I remember my favorite childhood movie, Totoro. The characters in the movie had great respect for nature, moving into a house specifically because it was shaded by an ancient tree that was hundreds of years old. The forest around the house was inhabited by a nature spirit, a Totoro, the king of the forest, who guarded it. If you were respectful to nature, the guardian was respectful to you. I remember placing flowers under all the trees in my backyard, hoping I could have an adventure too. The class 10 Ways to Know Nature helped me understand that some of the ways I perceive nature have been ingrained into me by the films of my childhood and even by the films I see now. Film is a very active aspect of art. Up next on our radio show, Stephanie and Lauren will explain nature through art.
They explored the galleries and pieces of art in the Easton area,
and interviewed students on how works of art impacted their view of nature. This was Nature in Films.
With Jen.
And Carolina.
Thanks for tuning in.
And hang around for the rest of the show.
That's all, folks.
We encounter nature every day, from our morning commutes across campus, to the food we purchase at Lower, to an afternoon hike on the Arts Trail. But have you ever stopped to admire nature through an artistic lens? A simple act of encountering nature daily becomes significantly profound when we connect art and nature. My name is Lauren Hunt, and I'm here with my co-host Stephanie Nickerson. In today's podcast, we will be taking a walking tour around Easton to help us better understand the relationship of art and nature.
Looking down on the rushing water of the Delaware River from the Gallup Park on a beautiful fall day, I see a beautiful scene of vibrant colors of the leaves on the trees. This is a view anyone with an appreciation of the beauty of nature would admire. From where we sit here at Gallup Park, a nature reserve with a spectacular view of the Delaware River, we are forming mental images as we greet nature. When we greet picturesque scenes like Gallup Park or a painting of the Amazon rainforest, we make connections between reality and our imagination. We see nature as a divine nature as ideology, and it allows us to better understand the environment around us.
As we walk into downtown Easton to the Grossman Gallery, an art exhibit featuring paintings and sculptures, we are wondering if the nature you understand by looking at the sculptures and paintings in the gallery is different from that of the nature experienced at Gallup Park.
Lauren, what do you think?
Well, looking specifically at this piece, Curb, by Jamie Cabreza here in the gallery, I see the beauty of nature. Just like the view at Gallup Park of the change of seasons in the leaves from summer to fall, the ice melting against the gutter and the tender, colorful, wind-blown blossoms celebrate nature's divine control and power. I think by framing the power of nature in its most mundane form in this piece, for example, a person who views this piece gets inspired by the meaning behind it.
Just a few steps away from Grossman Gallery is the Bushkill Curtain, an installation of string and blue painted buoys which are attached like a curtain and shift with the currents of the wind.
People pass over the Bushkill Creek every day on their daily commutes, but how many stop to think about the function of this site-specific sculpture? Take a listen here as artist Stacey Levy explains how the dynamic changes in nature can be seen in her piece.
My name is Stacey Levy. I'm an artist who works with natural processes. My work is all about showing how nature works, showing the changes over time that are sometimes difficult to see. Things like high water are really hard to register. You could walk past something and say, oh yeah, the water looks kind of high, and then 3 days later, can't quite tell if it's gone down. So I've created with this project, Bushkill Curtain, a kind of registration of the water level. When the water's really flowing high in the creek, the strands of buoys will go more horizontal, and when it's at low flow, they'll be very vertical the way they are right now. That as they cross the 3rd Street Bridge, they're not just thinking about going up the steps or out to Dunkin' Donuts, but they're going to pause and admire their incredible stream, because I'm going to add something kind of unusual for them to look at, and maybe they'll just always look over the edge of this bridge and think about the changeability of nature and yet the permanence of it too.
As Stacey Levy explained, the changeability and unpredictability of nature are important to understanding our connections with nature. From the transition between two seasons, portrayed in the Curb piece, to the view of Gallup Park, and then to the shifts in density and water flow of the Bushkill Creek, change is a constant factor in nature which art can portray.
You
Now we are going to travel to an outdoor art exhibit, Storm King, in the lower Hudson Valley. We will provide insight into how the artists who have constructed the site-specific sculptures, which featured in the 500-acre landscape of fields, hills, and woodlands, have connected to nature throughout their work. One of the main exhibitions at Storm King is Andy Goldsworthy's Storm King Wall.
This sculpture took 5 men, 17 days, and 15 boulders to construct. Goldsworthy embraces the natural landscape of the woods and the found materials to create a playground in which the sculpture weaves in and out of the trees in the forest and through the small pond. It seems to me that it doesn't disturb nature around it and feels rather natural. As it emerges into the water of the pond and continues to the other side, this wall is meant to be there for a reason.
Listen as one of our fellow classmates reflects on how his experience at Storm King influenced his perception of the relationship between art and nature.
When I first heard of the Storm King trip, I was expecting to see a field with a few large-scale sculptures that were strategically placed on top of the land. When we arrived, I was in awe of how the artists manipulated the natural resources and layout of the land in order to construct visual masterpieces that perfectly fit into their surroundings. Because we went on a beautiful fall day, I specifically noticed how the vibrant red and black colors of the pieces in the main field stood out. Overall, I thought that my adventures at Storm King helped me better understand how to see nature through an artistic perspective, which I had never done before.
Now, Lauren, since we have gone through a whole semester with our class, what have you learned about nature through art that you didn't know before?
I have always been very active in nature living in northern New Jersey. I appreciate all elements of the natural world, from the changes of seasons in the mountains to the view of the Delaware River from our campus, and especially the rhythmic flow of the waves on my favorite beach in Cape Cod. On the other hand, I have taken art classes my whole life, and even took advanced sculpture last year. Through this class, I have learned how to interpret the nature in artwork and also the art in nature. In each piece of artwork and each scenic location that we have visited, I now ponder the meanings behind them of humanitarian purposes, nature as ideology, and functional art. What about you, Steph?
For me, when first looking at nature, I thought the only things that are related to nature was outdoors. I would never have thought that nature and artwork had such a close connection. I feel by going to the gallery, specifically Grossman Gallery, it has really opened up my eyes that nature is always around us, and in many ways that we don't ever think. We have to realize that most of what artwork is based on is nature, such as photography titled The Curb. I believe nature is the basis of most artists' drawing ideas. In addition, I see nature as a piece of art because of how picturesque it truly is. I have to say, by standing and looking over the Gallup Park, it's hard not to want to take thousands of pictures because of how beautiful the view is.
Well, this is all the time that we have for today. I hope that we have opened your eyes to see the gorgeous connection between art and nature.
That was Stephanie and Lauren discussing how to find nature in art and how to find art in nature. I'm joined now by Sean and Jacob, who researched the correlation between religion and nature, to talk about the sublimeness found in landscape portraits. What do you two think about the usefulness of sublime lighting in landscape pieces?
Well, we're trying to capture the essence of the vision behind nature. Like Lauren and Steph pointed out, there are these landscapes that were trying to evoke this sublime feeling. And we kind of are here to ask the question, is there a correlation to that sublimity and the divine?
Yeah, and these landscape paintings that they're looking at, really, these are just visual representations of finding the divinity within nature, which is what we will be discussing in our podcast.
Hello, this is Sean.
And Jacob.
And you are listening to the religious segment of 10 Ways to Know Nature.
Today we will be focusing on finding divinity behind nature.
Nature is pure.
When it is untouched and unmodified by human hands, we as humans perceive it as the representation of unadulterated beauty. It is because of nature's purity and beauty that people of all religions are able to find something divine within it.
We had a chance to speak with religious leader Chaplain Hendrickson.
We asked her thoughts on divinity behind nature.
I don't think that you would look at nature, look at the beauty, and decide there must be a God because the world is so beautiful. But I think that if you do have a faith, if you do believe in a higher power, in a deity of some kind, then it's very easy to make the jump to there must be a God. So, you know, I don't know. That's my own, that's from really coming at it from my own experience.
As Chaplain Hendrickson said, you can find divinity behind nature through your own experience.
Which leads us to think that regardless of religion, you can always find divinity within nature. However, if you do associate with a religion, though, that could influence how you perceive it. In her Ecology of the Jewish Spirit, Ellen Bernstein raises the issue that Jews often believe that Israel is the only land that is holy. She says that this belief can translate into indifference toward their own environments. Personally, I do not have this issue. As a Jew, I do have an inherent connection to the land of Israel and many sites in it, such as the Kotel and Masada. These places represent important events in the history of my people and carry with them stories of struggle and perseverance. They connect me with my past as well as my spirituality, but there are places other than Israel that I feel connected to. Having spent my entire life less than half a block away from Prospect Park, I have gradually come to feel very close to it, and it's safe to say that the connection I have with it is one of my strongest. Contrary to what Bernstein says, I find it easier to be close with a place that is readily available to me. I am, in a sense, geographically inclined to have a connection with the park.
There's belief that Christianity has done nothing for the conservation of nature. This view suggests Christians believe they are above nature, as if they control it rather than nurture it. Wendell Berry, a famous environmental activist mentioned earlier by Luis and Julia, believes this ignorance is absurd. He states, "If we read the Bible, we will discover that we humans do not own the world or any part of it. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof." Personally, I am a Christian and I do agree with Wendell Berry. I do not own nature or any part of it. It is more equitable and connectable than that. But how do I as a Christian connect with nature? I do believe there is a God behind everything, but I'd rather look at it with a more simplistic view. I can see divinity behind nature whenever I feel at peace with my surroundings, as if everything in that moment was in harmony. Then it's easier to see something greater in the background. For instance, a simple hike to clear my mind can evoke a feeling of peace and make me feel spiritually connected.
Following up with the idea of spirituality in nature, we went around asking people where they have a connection to nature.
Coming from LA, it's like very hard like to, you know, feel connected to nature. Like, you don't see the stars out at night. There's this one time I went to Yosemite as a kid. It was probably in the sixth grade or something like that. And it made me realize that the contrast between the city and, like, going out there, like, made me realize I have to go out there more often. That's where I find my connection to nature.
Well, I grew up in the hills of Kingston, Jamaica, and I'd usually run each day, like, run up into the hills for my exercise, and it's really beautiful, like the trees, like the sounds of birds and whatnot. It really makes me feel, it made me feel calm and connected, like I was connected with it.
The river, when I row crude, the reflection of the natural light on the water really helps remind me of any philosophical questions on spirituality I have.
This summer I went to the Grand Canyon, and standing on the edge, just looking at how vast it was, it made you feel like there was something behind it.
We just heard from Ian Vera Cruz, Martin Gentles, Dan Crowley, and Connor Staggerwald.
Most humans can find this connection to nature, but it goes deeper than just the individual connection. It's how everything is connected, like an interconnected web. This web, or ordering, sometimes referred to as natural order, is more complex and nonlinear than it seems.
Addressing this subject of natural order, Chaplain Hendrickson offered her point of view of this interconnected web and where humans fit in it.
Well, I mean, I definitely believe that humans have a role as stewards of creation, but I don't think that it can be as hierarchical in the sense that, like, humans are the highest created order, and I think that it's more interconnected than that, because that hierarchy doesn't really work, because obviously when we've thought we were in charge of creation, we've screwed it up. So I think we obviously need to think of that, you know, we need to tip that on its side in some way and imagine it's not just what can we get from the world, what can we get from animals and nature, but what is our role to play.
Again, Chaplain Hendrickson raises an interesting point. What is our role? This question has been asked since the beginning of humanity, and different people have come up with a variety of answers. Religious doctrines were written around this question, and because of it, religions answer it differently. It turns out, though, that there are some striking similarities between the main global religions as well as between the less prominent religions of the world.
Despite their perceived differences, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism share very similar beliefs regarding nature. Their understanding of nature is that it is a gift of God. Because it is a gift, it is the human's role to protect it. However, this role of protector comes with it some level of superiority. You protect that which is inferior to you. It is even written in the first book of the Old Testament, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground.
Some less prominent religions, such as the African traditional religions and varying Native American religions, held beliefs far from those of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. Instead of ranking humans above their environment, these religions simply thought of humans as an active part of nature. They were no greater than it, but no lesser at the same time. Nature acted as a teacher, provided them with sustenance, and gave them their spirituality. All of this, along with the quality they afforded nature, allowed the Native Americans and the Africans a very intimate connection with nature, one they cherished.
While characteristic of these religions, this appreciation of nature is universal. As expressed by us and those we interviewed, anyone can have a spiritual connection to their environment. We encourage you listeners to go and seek your own connection to nature. Who knows, perhaps you might find some divinity behind it. Thanks for tuning in on Sean
and Jacob's
podcast. Now we're sending it back to John.
Just as religion can influence one's perspective of nature, so can one's origin, where they're born, where they play, and where they grow up. I'd like to introduce Bill and Kuhn, who are two international students from China, who did a study on how their life back in China compares to their life now in the United States, and all the different ways that they view nature between the two different homes.
Hi, everyone, I'm Bill.
I'm Quinn. We're students of Lafayette College. This is a podcast for first year seminar 18, 10 Ways to Know Nature.
We both come from China and now studying here. Having different cultural background, Quinn and I understand nature in a different way.
So now we're going to discuss the differences and similarities of understanding nature in Chinese and American culture.
Talking about nature, Quinn, how do you see and understand it? Do you have any stories to share with us?
Well, my understanding of nature changes as I grow up. I live in a city, however, my hometown is in the countryside, and every year I go to my hometown to see my grandparents. When I was 6 years old, the road conditions were really bad. Sometimes, heavy rain and mud rock flow would destroy the road. Nature has a mighty power to destroy artificial things, and that was my first impression of nature. Well, my father was driving back to the country, sitting in the car did not bore me. I always looked out the window of the car and saw the nature scenes. The roads were usually built in the middle of the mountains. I would look up through one side of the window, and there were so many mountains that I could not see the top of them. I would look down the other side of the road, and I would see long rivers with abundant water. Small trees and shrubs were beside the rivers. Looking further through the same side, I could see the full views of large mountains covered with green shrubs. Though the car ride took me more than 2 hours, I still enjoyed it a lot. When I arrived at the countryside, I remembered that I used to herdship with my grandma, and it was great fun. My grandparents kept chicken and pigs in their yard at that time. As such, I regarded the countryside as nature and saw it differently from the city, which only contains roads and buildings. Unfortunately, things have changed a lot.
So, what is it like now? Why it has changed a lot?
Now, when I go back to the countryside, it only takes half an hour to drive there by the highway. However, I become bored because there is nothing interesting to see while looking outside the window. The rivers have gradually dried up, and the trees beside the river have disappeared. In my grandparents' home, they are no longer keeping the sheep, chicken, and pigs. The contrasts make me feel that the nature is the way that everything used to be.
So you are saying that landscapes, animals, and humans make up nature. But as humans exploit the part of landscapes and animals, nature becomes less natural.
Yes, that's right. Do you know any stories that can provide us a Western view of nature?
Sure. Do you know the Noah Walden written by Thoreau?
Yeah, tell us about it.
The Noah Walden contains Thoreau's thoughts and personal experience of nature. While living along the forest for over 2 years, Thoreau did many observations and he learned so much about nature. For instance, he observed nature so often that he knew each opening time of Walden Lake during 1845, and he took the day-to-day changes of the lake to be indicative of the yearly changes. Staying in the forest for a long time, Thoreau also held the attitude that people should cherish and keep nature untouched from civilization. In other words, he thought that wilderness is true nature.
As we can see, while both Thoreau and I cherish nature, we understand it differently. I see nature as a place that I can interact with, but Thoreau understands nature as a true wilderness. In other words, a place can be called nature until it is touched and civilized by human. This might be a cultural difference that people from different backgrounds see in nature.
That's right. I also found an article named The Wilderness Letter, written by Wallace Stegner, holds the notion that we need to consider wilderness as nature. Seeing through these examples, we may guess the main difference is whether humans' activities exist to affect the definition of nature. Artworks are always one important part of how people understand nature. Do you know something about Chinese painting? How do Chinese artists depict nature?
Chinese painting, generally speaking, are divided into three types. Mountain and water painting, which focuses on the relationship of natural landscapes and human. Flower and bird painting, which stresses on the relationship of plants and animals in nature and human. And figure painting, which emphasizes on the relationship inside human society. These three parts altogether make up the nature. Chinese artists observe the nature first, then draw the paintings with reflections and skills. Ban Qiaozheng was a Chinese painter and a magistrate at Shandong province in Qing Dynasty. He, as a painter, was famous for his bamboo painting. His paintings also reflected his personal belief and principles. One of his famous works called Bamboos and Stones demonstrates that people should not change their belief even if they suffer from heavy pressure or encounter great difficulties. Just like the bamboos keep straight between the hard stones and in the harsh wind.
That's interesting. We also have learned some American painters' concepts of nature in class. For example, the article Hudson River School written by Mark Brough talk about how a group of landscape painters were affected by nationalism and romanticism appreciate the wilderness. The author wrote in the book, quote, "But America did still have something that Europe no longer possessed. An abundance of majestic wilderness, where sublime encounters with the divine might still take place," unquote. This shows these artists' love of wild nature. They depict and love the wilderness in their artworks. Moreover, through Thomas Cole's The Cause of Empire, the author used five drawings to show the same imaginary harbor city and depict the growth and decline of a city to illustrate that human beings are too tiny and insignificant to compare with the great nature.
Through Chinese and American paintings, we can see the differences between the artist's concept of nature. While Chinese artists use the natural scene and objects to not only show the beauty of nature, but also express their emotion or beliefs. However, the American artists draw nature to admire its sublimity.
Yes, exactly. I think we can conclude it as Chinese artists seeing nature more personally, while the American artists take nature more impersonal. We can also see through the different styles of Chinese and American paintings. While American artists try to draw the exact scene of nature using oil painting, Chinese artists depict nature more abstractly.
It's probably the time to say goodbye. Although there are a lot more aspects can show the comparison of Chinese and American culture, such as value, food, and religion. Due to the time limit, we are unable to talk about them today. However, through personal experience and art, we can already see the distinctions of understanding nature of each culture.
And if you are interested and want to know more, we also provide some additional articles in the reference list. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
With Bill and Kuhn's piece, this concludes part one of the 10 Ways to Know Nature podcast broadcast. As a closing thought before I hand the show over to Scott Oliveri for part two, I know I will take into account this holiday season that my actions do influence others around the world, and that from what I believe in to what I buy and eat to even the films that I watch, nature constantly changes. And I leave it to you, listeners, to discover and know what you can do to guarantee that the world changes for the better. I've been your host, John Ottinger, and I hope you take care and have happy holidays. Bye! Enough to laugh.